Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 2 of season 10. I've been using Boris FX products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with Yorgos Mavropsaridis, ACE, the editor of Oscar shortlister Poor Things. Yorgos was an ACE nominee for The Lobster. He was nominated for a BAFTA and an Oscar and won the ACE Eddy for The Favorite. In addition, he's edited The Killing of a Sacred Deer and has over 100 international film credits. Yorgos was a previous guest on Art of the Cut for The Favorite. Before I hop into our discussion with Yorgos, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no limits, 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen. And for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmark. And now, Yorgos Mavropsaridis, ACE, discusses editing Poor Things. The music is very interesting, and I would think it would have been very difficult to temp, because there's nothing else out there like it that I can think of.
We didn't temp. It was, as a matter of fact, it's the first time we used a composer. All our previous films were classical music mostly, but Lakmos listened to Jeskin's album. He liked his music a lot, and he suggested to compose the music. And as a matter of fact, the music was composed months before shooting started. You know, not the exact music as it was in the film, but the general themes. So we could have them when in a certain stage in the editing we needed them. So almost after the assembly, we started using music, but also Lanthimos used a lot of this music in the shooting during the production. Like, you know, I could hear a scene with three different music. So there was no decision what piece of music was going to be there or there, but it was a matter of trying and stuff. So yes, from the beginning, in the process of the edit, after the assembly, after the first cut, because we usually do that, I started using this music. Of course, sometimes we had to edit the music, to add some meters, to take out some other, to combine it. Sometimes it was done nicely. Sometimes we had to send it back to Jeskin to have a feedback and for him to work. But yes, it was not them. It was this music from the very beginning.
You mentioned that you could hear it on set and he was playing multiple choices. Was he trying to get the actors to feel different by playing different pieces of music?
Yes, it's not the first time. He's done it also, I remember, in The Killing of the Sacred Deer. There was a lot of music, you know, for the actors to get in the mood. Like, for example, when Bella is exiting through the roof and sees for the first time the rooftop of London, there was different music for her to somehow get inspired by the music, to have this surprise and this first time of seeing something. Yes, it was music also to set the rhythm for the movements, because he likes the choreography of the actor. It's not only the facial expressions, it's the movement that gets influenced. In many scenes, music was used to influence the actor, different kind of music.
Many movies start off where the audience doesn't quite know what's happening. It's a bit of a mystery how the film starts. And this is one like that. You don't quite know what's happening. How long can you be in that place of having the audience be in that mystery?
The script at the beginning was that we start with Bella in the black and white as a strange woman, baby woman. But there was the option already I discussed with Yorgos. Yes, this fantastic shot from the back of her without revealing her face, going towards her head and then she's falling. Yes, it does create, as you say, a question mark, a curiosity, what is happening. We keep that in mind, of course, in the editing, in the sense that it's not like the images or the situations succeed one another. It's like they're overlapping. So there is a point when you need to answer that. And yes, the explanation of the answer has to be there somehow formally. And this was, of course, the woman, but also the music. It's the same music that comes in when we hear the music first in the beginning and then in the revelation when Godwin Baxter says, "I shall tell you because it is a happy tale," and the music starts, we do connect. The span of this depends on us understanding, you know, as our brains work, we do need to have that in mind. So yes, there is always, up to that point, there's a lot of more small question marks, small question marks. And yes, and this point reveals itself, as a matter of fact. And it's just a brain's process for me. It's not like the length of time. It's what information we have accumulated up to that point and when it is best to give it. And it feels right. It feels right. But it depends always on the different circumstances. But it cannot be too long. The distance, because people will forget it, or you know, you don't want them to say, "Oh, is that what he says now?" No, it has to be smooth and accepted, normal, you know, in a normal situation. I follow the thought patterns usually, how we perceive reality or how we perceive a narration, and the distance has to be quite close, but also filled with a lot of information, and you know, keeping that flame burning somehow.
Keeping the flame burning, that's a great way to put it. And it's different than the way the script is, right? Like the script can be written one way and feel like the revelations are happening correctly. But then when you cut the film together, it feels different.
Yes, it's true. And we did know that we had to reach that point earlier. As a matter of fact, the assembly or even the first cut, because we usually, when we do the first cut, we follow exactly the script. Of course, we look at the details, the actors playing, but the length is all there. Yes, and we had to make a lot of decisions to shorten this period. Like, for example, there is a sequence after Max comes in the house and, you know, he starts observing her. There were a number of scenes. And when she wakes up and when she feeds the animal, all this had to be compressed and made into a sequence somehow, shortened. Also, there was a sequence before the revelation when, you know, Max is involved romantically with her and Godwin Baxter takes advantage of that to keep Bella and him in the house. These were a series of scenes as well that were exposed in the script. But yes, we had to make a montage sequence to compress the situation in order to reach that revelation point, which is quite important earlier in the timeline of the film.
There are a number of shots that use an extremely wide angle, a fisheye lens. Did you need to understand the director's vision for those, or was it just that they appealed to you like any other coverage?
Yeah, there's no discussion about them, when to use them. As a matter of fact, in the especially in the first part and also in the second part, there were almost in every scene, there was, you know, the usual pattern was a fisheye lens and then a long shot or some movement stuff. But for me, I just find some reasons to use them. For example, the first time we used this fish lens was when we see Godwin Baxter going down the stairs. He hears the piano playing. He looks at her. So I thought, okay, that's a nice point of view from this strange man to use. And then the next time was when Max comes in and she rushes to Godwin Baxter's, you know, it's like a baby. I thought it was funny, like, you know, a grown-up woman being like a baby and maybe seeing it through Max's eyes for the first time, what is happening there, you know, this strange situation. So there's only small reasons. subliminally they might say something to a viewer, but you know, also in the dance sequence we use it once when this is a strange situation when these old people are fighting. It was a, you know, an unrealistic situation. So this is some small decisions, and sometimes it's like a punctuation, like for example when they are in the cruiser. There is this situation when Bella Baxter says to Duncan Wedderburn, "You're in my son," like, you know, Diogenes, the ancient philosopher, said to Alexander. So we cut to this strange lens when he throws the books away, so just to punctuate the situation. Different reasons all the time, yes.
So many of the scenes have a very simple cut transition. At one point, I love dissolves, always think there's a purpose to them. There is a cut to Bella in bed tucked in by, with her father, and then there's a dissolve to her finger pointing at a map. Why choose to use a dissolve at that point?
Well, we're always looking for formal reasons to use them at that particular point. I think the lingering image of her sleeping was the important for me, just to see her drawn into sleep and then cut to the other one. Also, there's another nice dissolve I like after Godwin Baxter finishes the explanation and he says, "Does he know about it?" And we cut to this fisheye lens, which makes a very graphic, a very nice graphic match with the roundness of her eye waking up. So the reason is most of the time graphic matches. We don't want to say that time passed or anything. It's just appealing to us as a transition graphically most of the time, as a graphic match most of the time. Like, for example, we don't use it when, you know, even when it could be used, like, for example, later in the scene when after she meets Archie and they have this discussion, there's a close-up of her. Of course, maybe someone would use a transition there to have the time pass because she's now leaving dinner and she's thinking about it. But no, it's a straight cut. So it doesn't have to be used in the usual way of time transition. We don't need that. We just need the graphics of it, or, you know, the beauty of it, the transition, or some smaller idea. Like, okay, she's in bed sleeping and then abruptly interrupted by the finger.
Was it scripted on when to go to color and when to go black and white?
Well, no, I think, but it was in Yorgos Dekoupas from the beginning to have the first part, all of it, as a homage to the old films about the Gothic situations in black and white. We broke that by introducing the color picture in the beginning. And also it was broken, but in an interesting way, when Godwin Baxter recites the story of Victoria Blessington, how he found her, you know, being pregnant with a baby, that was shot in color. So there was a good parallel in between black and white and color to separate, I guess, the time situation between the two. And then all the rest was in extreme color and also in different colors. Like, for example, the first part in Lisbon was with the color negative. Of course, the black and white was also negative. And then in the cruiser mainly, and in these parallel color situations in the beginning, it was shot in ektachrome, the old reversal. Lanthimos went to travel to find this German guy who had started developing ektachrome for the first time after so many years that was abandoned. And he used that because of the difference in the saturation of this ektachrome. It was much different than the other. It was more dark and more pensive. Like, you know, she's in the cruiser and she starts learning about things. It's not the first excitement in Lisbon, which is very colorful and bright. It's more dark, the situation there.
It wasn't like all shot in color and you could choose.
Oh, no, no. It was shot in black and white, in ektachrome and negative. And as a matter of fact, all the tests had been done long before the shooting started, the lens tests and also the color tests. So as a matter of fact, because Lanthimos likes to see almost the final product when we're editing, how it would look. We don't imagine it. It's there. I mean, of course, there were differences in when it went through color correction and everything, but the basic palette was there.
Does that having that palette help you as an editor feel the scenes properly?
Definitely it changes my feeling. And also, by way of talking about Yorgos, it's something that he doesn't allow. We cannot watch, we cannot work if there is nothing, you know, the feeling is not there, not only in the colors, but in the sound as well, in the basic visual effects my assistant had to do, you know, to take out the rails, to fill the skies, or even to combine some of the animals. It has to be as good as we can during the edit procedure.
There was a discussion at dinner about marrying Bella, and there are flash forwards and flashbacks. Was that all as scripted, or did you find that during that conversation you needed to change the way the script worked?
I mentioned it before as a way of compressing situations. It is a method that we have developed very early. As a matter of fact, we first did it when we worked on Dogtooth. We did it a lot also in Sacred Deer, and of course in The Favourite we do a lot. It's Yorgos likes to shoot his film in time and space continuity. He doesn't edit during the shooting. So all these are scenes, different scenes. But of course, we felt that it was a big scene, the dinner, a lot of discussion going on, and then followed by or preceded by other scenes when Bella is alone in the house and she wants, you know, it's a scene that says, I want out of here. And then there's a scene where she's playful with Max, and then Godwin Baxter walks in and he finds them in this situation and he wants to take advantage. And of course, it's the scene after that he proposes to her. And then there's a scene when Dagan Weatherby is arriving out with outside with the carriage and presenting the contract, the marriage contract. And we felt that we had to make this montage as the main point, keep the dinner, but then intersperse it, or you know, cut with the other situations in moments that in the edit we felt would benefit the film, and just keep the core of the other scenes. Like, we didn't have to see the whole scene of Bella waking up, seeing a map, going to the window, trying to break away and then leave. No, it was just enough to see here in front of there. It combined with, you know, with the phrase that Godwin says, but you must be here all the time with me. So she wants to go out. So you create this contrast and everything. It was all edited. Of course, these scenes take some time in the edit. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. Sometimes I have to try this thing, sometimes the other thing. But in the end, yes, it was done for this mainly purpose, to give some movement to the film, you know, when you feel that it's lagging a bit, and although the situation is nice, it's very funny. They're very funny when Godwin Baxter recites. I mean, I don't feel passionate for her because of all this, but all the rest had to be taken out to keep the film moving organically and not, you know, lag behind or make the viewer be ahead of us somehow, or, you know, be bored about what's happening.
She has dinner with a general. It's a fairly lengthy scene, a dinner table scene, and I noticed multiple times, to have the most interesting shots, you needed to jump the 180.
That's quite a difficult task, to keep the eye lines and the rule of 180 together all the time. Usually the way I think I used it was when the camera went from the back of a character, I thought I could change to the other situation, and everything was allowed as long as I kept the eye line correct. So not to disorient the audience, you don't need to disorient the audience, and use the movements usually mainly for these transitions, and then the straight cuts from movement to stillness, just to emphasize a thought or a feeling, or, you know, some reaction. The difficulty was that when you wanted to change a shot of her or of him, you had to go to the whole different dance because you could not use the other one that you like. So that was the main difficulty. You had to find the points from one point, from one situation or for the other. I had it both ways, in a matter of fact, but they could not be combined. You had to use either this or that. So it was all a matter of, you know, balancing these different movements and keeping the better performances, as a matter of fact.
There's a lovely scene where Bella dances without a care in the world. I would think that would have to be so difficult to cut. Can you talk about cutting that dance scene?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the first time I started doing that, I was following a wrong way because I felt that I had to keep the choreography intact. Of course, it was very nice to see her in a situation with other dancers, and I thought it was nice to keep this situation with, you know, with the other people around, dance so funny, and then she's there. But in the end, it was maybe too long, but also it was not what it was supposed to be. Like, what, for the first time, this at this age, she's about 16 years old, she sees this and she wants to dance, but she hasn't danced before, and so it had to be a bit awkward. The idea in the end became like it was a small world of the of her bigger world. She's feeling awkward, but then she's excited at what she's doing there, and she doesn't care about what other people think, and we didn't have to care about if her movements were choreographed or anything. It had to be spontaneous. The choreography had to concentrate on her situation, like, okay, what is happening with her? Everybody and wants to control her. So the main part of the choreography we had to keep was these things when he puts his arm around her, trying to manipulate her, and then she reacts, and this is, had to be like a microcosm of the whole situation for her.
The story of the dance is the same as the story of the whole movie.
That was the final decision to keep and take out all the embellishment of the other choreographers, as a matter of fact, which took away from this simple, authentic fact.
Does the fantastic nature of the story make it easier or harder to edit?
I don't think he has ever done a film which is realistic, as a matter of fact, or a representation of a reality. He does like, and he does create a world all the time, even in our old films. So once you are immersed in this world, you accept all these things. The difficulty for Lanthimos films is the difficulty of Lanthimos films. The way he approaches and the degree of difficulty, it's much more difficult than any other film because, you know, always we have to find a new way to say things, although the language is there. It's, you know, it's easily recognizable that this is a Lanthimos film. We have to be free and not to repeat ourselves, as a matter of fact, but stay in that same situation. And yes, the difficulty doesn't arise from being fantastic or anything. On the contrary, it gives you a more playfulness to use and everything. But in the end, because it all this, as a matter of fact, is directed to the viewer's perception and plays with it, it gives you a more interesting way to approach it and to, you know, edit it, not as a presentation, but as a proposition, you know, or as a surprise or a feeling to the audience, and try to make him co-creator with what you're doing. There's always something slightly missing, maybe, and, you know, you need to trust the audience that they're going to fill the gaps, or they're going to put their own perspective to that.
Are you conscious of trying not to put a perspective on so that it's easier for them to put their own idea?
It's always, and if I'm not, Lanthimos is there to remind me that, you know, this is not a representational film. We're not doing something to present to the audience. We need them to get involved, but not in the usual way. Proposing something, let's talk about this, and leave some questions for the audience to answer. Usually, although this is this film is the most precise, and the thesis in that film is very well presented, and but it does give the audience a lot of food for thought, as a matter of fact. It, you know, doesn't answer all the questions, it does poses. It, of course, it does give very definite direction to Bella's understanding in the end, because she goes through a lot of experiences, she's learning a lot of things, but in the end she's not like she doesn't know what to do. She has decided that she's going to fix the wrong aspects of humanity and dedicate herself to science directly with her husband. Like, for example, this situation is presented in a way that is not usual. It's not a romantic love affair. They're getting married. Why? They're not in love somehow, you know. They like each other, but their main purpose is to work in the science, to keep their freedom. Don't forget that in the end, she's bringing her girlfriend, let's say, together in that lunch scene from the brothel in Paris. So small things say a lot of things. You know, small details contain a bigger world, I think.
You mentioned a little bit about how you collaborate with Yorgos, and you've done multiple films together. what is that process? Does he bother looking at scenes you've cut when he's on, when he's shooting, or has he got other things to do?
He never looks at what we're doing. For example, I remember in Lobster, there was a scene when suddenly in the middle of the day, there was rain and they had to stop shooting. So I had to edit that to see if we have enough or we can do something different. But that was the only time, as I remember. Mostly I do the assembly when I'm here, and you know, I presented to him 2 weeks after the shooting. This was such a difficult and long film that we didn't see the whole film. We just watched sections of that. I take notes of what he says, and also I make my own notes because, you know, it's just an assembly. There's a lot of things to be done there. So, yeah, we usually meet weekly, once or twice a week, to see what I've done and discuss certain options, you know, during all this process. The beginning is about the actors, about the decoupage, which shot he likes or not, that set the mood, and for, you know, say a lot about the character. And then when we have reached this point, when everything is in place, we have a very long 3.5 hour film, music comes, and we do what we name deconstruction. We have constructed, now let's take it apart and see what we can do, and, you know, try this or we'll try this. He's very precise in what he wants. He doesn't say much, but, you know, being with Yorgos almost 25 years now, I know what he means, and I know which way I have to take the film. And also I feel that I have a lot of freedom from him to try things. Although they're not discussed, if I have an inspiration, let's say in the middle of the night, I will do it, and, you know, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. Yeah, we have reached, after many trials and error and many hours, you know, and many films together, we have reached a very understanding way of working, I believe. I believe that Poor Things was our, I would say, easier film to edit. Not easy in the sense of anything else, but in the sense of understanding immediately the needs of the film and going towards this direction together, not losing ourselves in that.
You mentioned having a brainstorm in the middle of the night. Were you cutting at home? Or
usually we do have our office that we meet there, but I don't go to the office when I'm doing alone. I prefer to do it from my house, and, you know, I see it as a, not as work, as a matter of fact, but some more creative thing. And it's easier for me to do it here because, you know, I can do it anytime. But yes, we do have our office. As a matter of fact, we've built one after the film, with the new one, we did it, which has to have, like, we have a big screen with a projector to watch it sometimes, or a plasma TV for sometimes to see nice colors. You know, we use this small black magic gadget to have the exact colors we see in the avid, to have it in our projector as well. So yes, it's mainly for going to the office to sit with Yorgos, watch the film, you know, do a screening or have a technical pass, go through places to discuss about things, or me to take notes. And most of the time I take it and I work on my own, because, you know, I don't think there's any point in the director being there when you try things, or you throw away, or you cut a frame, or you cut 10 frames, or you try different things. It's it's better to keep the director away and have him show him the you know, and then he can comment on the big picture, as a matter of fact.
I'm trying to remember, did the two of you meet cutting TV spots, cutting advertising?
Right. I mean, there is a generational difference between me. I think I'm 20 years older than Yorgos. I was in the commercial business a lot, mainly for, you know, to put the food in my family's table and everything. We all did that. And Yorgos came into the commercial. He started doing some video clips on his own. Also, he had directed the theatrical plays. And then he started working on the commercials. As a matter of fact, I did cut his first commercial, and then we became collaborators in the commercial business. We did a lot of commercials together, and it was that period that connected us, in the sense that our main love was films. It was not commercials. But of course, commercials gave us the opportunity to practice. gave me the opportunity to practice, you know, the detail of a frame or two frames, or try to create an impression or an emotion in 30 seconds. For Yorgos, I saw immediately that he was using commercials. He was a, you know, very well known commercial director. Everybody wanted him to direct, but he used them as a means of trying different narrational ideas, and also aesthetically, production-wise, to how to do this scene. And he was, as a matter of fact, building his own narrative way of talking or narrating things already in the commercials. It was the idea that the creator is responsible for this. Even if it was a commercial, he didn't do it as somebody do that. No, he took it as his own little poem or a little narrative situation, and that was it. You couldn't do it differently. I've been in many presentations with a client asking for, can we have this close-up there? There's no close-up. Take it or leave it. We did keep the, of course, in Dogtooth, we didn't have any producer to tell us what to do, but after we went to the bigger films, he's still, you know, trying, and as a matter of fact, does have the final cut of the films, and he likes to control every aspect of filmmaking.
Yorgos, thank you so much for joining me on Art of the Cut and for this fascinating discussion about this film.
Thank you very much, Steven. It was nice to see you again after, what was it, 2019?
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Yorgos Mavropsaridis, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hulfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.